Why won't Teal come in here? I asked him.
Man's got a problem, the old guy said. I figure he don't like to sit all swathed up in the towel while there's a black man standing next to him with a razor. Maybe worried something bad might happen to him.
Might something bad happen to him? I said. He laughed a short laugh.
I figure there's a serious risk, he said. Asshole.
So you got enough black customers to make a living? I asked him. He put the towel around my shoulders and started brushing on the lather.
Man, we don't need customers to make a living, he said.
You don't? I said. Why not?
We got the community money, he said.
You do? I said. What's that?
$1,000,
he said. Who gives you that? I asked him. He started scraping my chin. His hand was shaking like old people do.
Kleiner Foundation, he whispered. The community program is a business grant. Older merchants get it. Been getting it 5 years.
I nodded. That's good, I said. But $1,000 a year won't keep you. It's better than a poke in the eye, but you need customers too, right? I was just making conversation like you do with barbers, but it set the old guy off. He was shaking and cackling, had a whole lot of trouble finishing the shave. I was staring into the mirror. After last night, it would be a hell of a thing to get my throat cut by accident.
Man, I shouldn't tell you about it, he whispered. But seeing as you're a friend of my sister's, I'm going to tell you a big secret. Man, I shouldn't tell you about it, he whispered. But seeing as you're a friend of my sister's, I'm going to tell you a big secret.
He was getting confused. I wasn't a friend of his sister's, didn't even know her. He'd told me about her, was all. He was standing there with the razor. We were looking at each other in the mirror, like with Finley in the coffee shop.
It's not $1,000 a year, he whispered.
Then he bent close to my ear.
It's $1,000 a week.
He started stomping around, chuckling like a demon. He filled the sink and dabbed off the spare lather, patted my face down with a hot, wet cloth. Then he whipped the towel off my shoulders like a conjurer doing a trick.
That's why we don't need no customers,
he cackled. I paid him and got out. The guy was crazy.
Say hello to my sister,
he called after me. Chapter 17. The trip to Atlanta was the best part of 50 miles. Took nearly an hour. The highway swept me right into the city. I headed for the tallest buildings. Soon as I started to see marble foyers, I dumped the car and walked to the nearest corner and asked a cop for the commercial district. He gave me a half-mile walk, after which I found one bank after another. Sunrise International had its own building. It was a big glass tower set back behind a piazza with a fountain. That part looked like Milan, but the entranceway at the base of the tower was clad in heavy stone, trying to look like Frankfurt or London, trying to look like a big, heavy-duty bank. Foyer full of dark carpet and leather, receptionist behind a mahogany counter. Could have been a quiet hotel. I asked for Paul Hubbell's office, and the receptionist flipped through a directory. She said she was sorry, but she was new in the job and she didn't recognize me, so would I wait while she got clearance for my visit? She dialed a number and started a low conversation. Then she covered the phone with her hand.
May I say what it's in connection with?
I'm a friend, I said. She resumed the phone call and then directed me to an elevator. I had to go to reception on the 17th floor. I got in the elevator and tapped the button, stood there while it carried me up. The 17th floor looked even more like a gentleman's club than the entrance foyer had. It was carpeted and paneled and dim, full of glowing antiques and old pictures. As I waded across the thick pile, a door opened and a suit stepped out to meet me, shook my hand, and fussed me back into a little anteroom. He introduced himself as some sort of a manager, and we sat down.
"So, how may I help you?"
he asked. "I'm looking for Paul Hubble," I said.
"May I know why?"
"He's an old friend," I said. I remembered him saying he works here, so I thought I'd look him up while I'm passing through. The guy in the suit nodded, dropped his gaze.
"Thing is, you see," he said, "Mr. Hubble doesn't work here anymore. We had to let him go, I'm afraid, about, 18 months ago."
I just nodded blankly. Then I sat there in the clubby little office and looked at the guy in the suit and waited. A bit of silence might set him talking. If I asked him questions straight out, he might clam up. He might go all confidential like lawyers do. But I could see he was a chatty type of a guy. A lot of those managers are. They love to impress the hell out of you, given the chance. So I sat tight and waited. Then the guy started apologizing to me because I was Hubble's friend.
"No fault of his own, you understand," he said. "He did an excellent job. But it was in a field we moved out of. A strategic business decision. Very unfortunate for the people concerned, but there you are."
I nodded at him like I understood.
"I haven't been in touch for a long time," I said. "I didn't know. I didn't even really know what he did here."
I smiled at him, tried to look amiable and ignorant. Didn't take much effort in a bank. I gave him my best receptive look, guaranteed to set a chatty guy talking. It had worked for me plenty of times before.
"He was part of a retail operation," the guy said. "We closed it down."
I looked inquiringly at him.
"Retail?"
I said.
"Over-the-counter banking," he said. "You know, cash, checks, loans, personal customers."
"And you close that down?" I said.
"Why?" "Oh, too expensive," he said. "Big overhead, small margin. It had to go."
"And Hubble was a part of that?" I asked him. He nodded.
"Mr. Hubble was our currency manager," he said. "It was an important position. He was very good."
"So what was his exact role?" I asked him. The guy didn't know how to explain it, didn't know where to start. He made a couple of attempts and gave them up.
Do you understand cash?" he said.
"I've got some," I said. "I don't know if I understand it exactly." He got to his feet and gave me a fussy gesture, wanted me to join him at the window. We peered out together at the people on the street, 17 floors down. He pointed at a guy in a suit hurrying along the sidewalk.
"Take that, gentleman," he said. "Let's make a few guesses, shall we? Probably lives in the outer suburbs, maybe has a vacation cabin somewhere. Two big mortgages, two cars, half a dozen mutual funds, IRA provisions, some blue chip stock, college plans, 5 or 6 credit cards, store cards, charge cards. Net worth about $500,000, shall we say?"
"Okay," I said.
"But how much cash does he have?" the guy asked me.
"No idea," I said.
"Probably about $50, he said. "About $50 in a leather billfold which cost him $150.
I looked at him. I wasn't following his drift. The guy changed gear, became very patient with me.
"The U.S. economy is huge," he said. "Net assets and net liabilities are incalculably large, trillions of dollars, but almost none of it is actually represented by cash. That gentleman had a net worth of $500,000, but only 50 of it was in actual cash. All the rest of it is on paper or in computers. The fact is, there isn't much actual cash around. There's only about 130 billion actual cash dollars inside the whole U.S.
I shrugged at him again. "Sounds like enough to me," I said. The guy looked at me severely.
"But how many people are there?" he asked me. "Nearly 300 million.
That's only about 450 actual cash dollars per head of population. That's the problem a retail bank has to deal with day by day. $450 is a very modest cash withdrawal. But if everybody chose to make such a withdrawal, the nation's banks would run out of cash in the blink of an eye. He stopped and looked at me. I nodded. Okay, I said. I see that. And most of that cash isn't in banks, he said. It's in Vegas or at the racetrack. It's concentrated in what we call cash-intensive areas of the economy. So a good currency manager, and Mr. Hubble was one of the very best, has a constant battle just to keep enough paper dollars on hand in our part of the system. He has to reach out and find them. He has to know where to locate them. He has to sniff them out. It's not easy. In the end, it was one of the factors which made retail so expensive for us. One of the reasons why we pulled out. We kept it going as long as we could, but we had to close the operation eventually. We had to let Mr. Hubble go. We were very sorry about it. Any idea where he's working now, I said. He shook his head. Oh, I'm afraid not, he said. Must be working somewhere, right? I said. The guy shook his head again. Professionally, he's dropped out of sight, he said. He's not working in banking, I'm sure of that. His institute membership lapsed immediately, and we've never had an inquiry for a recommendation. I'm sorry, but I can't help you. If he was working anywhere in banking, I'd know it. I can assure you of that. He must be in something else now. I shrugged. Hubble's trail was stone cold, and the discussion with this guy was over. His body language indicated it. He was shifting forward, ready to get up and get on. I stood up with him, thanked him for his time, shook his hand, stepped through the antique gloom to the elevator, hit the button for the street, and walked out into the dull gray weather. My assumptions had been all wrong. I had seen Hubble as a banker doing a straight job, maybe turning a blind eye to some peripheral con, maybe with half a finger in some dirty pie, maybe signing off on a few bogus figures, with his arm twisted way up his back. Involved, useful, tainted, but somehow not central. But he hadn't been a banker. Not for a year and a half. He had been a criminal. Full time, right inside the scam, right at the center. Not peripheral at all. I drove straight back to the Margrave station house, parked up and went looking for Roscoe. Teal was stalking around in the open area, but the desk guy winked and nodded me back to a file room. Roscoe was in there. She looked weary. She had an armful of old files. She smiled.
Hello, Reacher, she said. Come to take me away from all this?
What's new? I said. She dumped the stack of paper onto a cabinet top, dusted herself off and flicked her hair back, glanced at the door.
Couple of things, she said. Teal's got a foundation board meeting in 10 minutes. I'm getting the facts from Florida as soon as he's out of here, and we're due a call from the state police about abandoned cars.
Where's the gun you've got for me? I asked her. She paused, bit her lip. She was remembering why I needed one.
It's in a box, she said, in my desk. We'll have to wait until Teal is gone. And don't open it here, okay? Nobody knows about it.
We stepped out of the file room and walked over toward the Rosewood office. The squad room was quiet. The two backup guys from Friday were paging through computer records. Neat stacks of files were everywhere. The bogus hunt was on for the chief's killer. I saw a big new bulletin board on the wall. It was marked Morrison. It was empty. Not much progress was being made. We waited in the Rosewood office with Finley. 5 minutes. 10. Then we heard a knock, and Baker ducked his head around the door. He grinned in at us. I saw his gold tooth again.
Teal's gone, he said.
We went out into the open area. Roscoe turned on the fax machine and picked up the phone to call Florida. Finley dialed the state police for news on abandoned rental cars. I sat down at the desk next to Roscoe's and called Charlie Hubble. I dialed the mobile number that Joe had printed out and hidden in his shoe. I got no answer.
Just an electronic sound and a recorded voice telling me the phone I was calling was switched off. I looked across at Roscoe.
"She's got the damn mobile switched off," I said.
Roscoe shrugged and moved over to the fax machine. Finley was still talking to the state police. I saw Baker hanging around on the fringe of the triangle the three of us were making. I got up and went to join Roscoe.
"Does Baker want in on this?" I asked her.
"He seems to," she said. "Finley's got him acting as a kind of a lookout. Should we get him involved?"
I thought about it for a second, but shook my head.
"No," I said. "Smaller the better, a thing like this, right?"
I sat down again at the desk I was borrowing and tried the mobile number again. Same result, same patient electronic voice telling me it was switched off.
"Damn," I said to myself. "Can you believe that?"
I needed to know where Hubble had spent his time for the last year and a half. Charlie might have given me some idea. The time he left home in the morning, the time he got home at night, toll receipts, restaurant bills, things like that. And she might have remembered something about Sunday or something about Pluribus. It was possible she might have come up with something useful, and I needed something useful. I needed it very badly. And she'd switched the damn phone off.